for them. They were shooting. Not if three heavily armed bikers couldn't survive against them, whoever they were. Shit. He should wait for the SWAT team. But if somebody was in trouble out there, he had to check it out. That's what they paid him to do. Well, shit. Sloan and Mary moved as quickly as they could through the forest. Their pursuer would be looking for another ambush now, and he'd have superior weapons to clear out any suspicious spots. Speed was what mattered. If they could make it to the biker's RV, get their truck or even a bike running, they could leave it behind. It probably had transportation somewhere, but an open road with the pedal to the metal was better than beating your way through the woods on foot. Sloan? He'll be moving, slower now. He doesn't know if we'll take another shot. Be a mistake for him to risk it. You hope? What I would do, and he's a hunter going after prey that just seriously wounded or killed his buddy. We should be able to stay ahead of him. Bhagauti mourned Nakande, even as she was angry with him. His dying breath, he had admitted it. He dismissed the Uman as serious prey because he was old. Age took strength and speed, but it didn't always take skill. Firing a weapon with which you had practiced 10,000 times, a squeeze of one digit, no strength or speed needed for that. She would not make the same mistake. They were running for the wheeled house that stank, where the other, less skilled Umans had died. It made sense. There had been transportation there, and they would think to outrun her that way. Her mandible twitched. It was a risk, but it made sense. Trying to follow them through the forest was not the best action. Best would be to arrive where they were going, before they did, and have them walk into her line of fire. Though maybe she would use her blades. It would be more satisfying that way. Max stayed off the trail, working his way through the brush carefully. Concealment wasn't cover, but if they didn't see him, they'd have a harder time zapping him with their lasers or whatever. He moved deliberately, not trying to hurry. Either the old couple had killed the bad guys, or they had been killed. There hadn't been any more firing, save those two shots. Likely whatever had happened was a done deal. And really, when he thought about it, he should wait for the SWAT team. But no, on the off chance somebody still needed his help, he had to go look. Sloan slowed down.
What?
He took a deep breath, let half of it out. Thinking here. If the creature behind us killed the bikers, then they know about the place.
So? Oh, wait.
Yeah, they would know about the truck and the bikes there.
You think they shredded tires there, too?
If they knew the bikers were dead, and they expected to catch us at home, maybe not.
Then what?
They know we are running, and the nearest quick escape would be the bikers' truck or motorcycles.
Yeah? And?
If I were tracking us, and I thought I knew where we were headed, moving slowly to keep from getting shot would be relatively safe, but circling around and moving fast to get there ahead of us, that would be my preference.
Crap.
If they have hunted people before, they have figured out how we think. It's the first thing you do with dangerous prey. You make it play your game.
I'm guessing that it might not be in our best interest to walk up to the biker's place without great care. Well, maybe... What's that?
He listened. Somebody ahead of us, coming this way, off trail.
The monster?
I don't know. Not making as much noise as I would think. Let's hunker down. Maybe it will step in front of our guns again. Mac had worked up a pretty good sweat. The trees shaded him, but the marine layer was burning off, and it was getting warmer. Probably hit 90 today, and he was wishing he had brought a water bottle or canteen. There was a stream not far, and if he wanted to risk getting sick from sipping water full of beaver and duck crap, he could get a drink. Should have brought his filter straw back in the unit's trunk. Should have brought the Marines and the Air Force while I'm thinking about it. He looked at his intended path ahead, mostly trees and bushes and blackberry brambles. He stepped into a small clearing.
"Don't shoot," Sloan whispered. "It's a deputy."
Mary said,
I'm not blind. I can see that.
Let's see if we can warn him without blasting the trees.
He started whistling the alien theme from Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Really, Sloane?
Who's there? Sheriff's office. Come out with your hands up.
Deputy, this is Sloane and Mary. We bought the old McGee place. You saw me at the shooting range.
Come out where I can see you. Put your weapons down.
Deputy, we really have to hurry this up. There's somebody else in the woods, and they are killers.
I saw the bikers. Come out.
We are wearing ghillie suits. We stand up, we are going to look like bushes. Our weapons are down. Don't shoot us.
Slow and easy.
They did that. Sloane already had his head cover shoved back, as did Mary.
Jesus, how did I miss you?
We didn't want you to see us.
What the fuck is going on here?
Step a little closer. We don't want to be yelling at each other.
Slaughter's on the way.
We'll need them, Sloane said.
Why did you whistle that tune?
To make you wonder just that, and not spray the woods with your shotgun.
Ah.
Mac said,
You are fucking kidding me.
Nope. We ran into these things in Alaska, almost a decade back. The feds know about them. It was a big explosion afterward. Wiped out the evidence. They're back.
You're crazy.
But he thought about the footprint. Bigger than any man's he'd ever seen.
You ever see anybody killed like those bikers?
No, but maybe it's some kind of black ops thing. A rival gang, maybe.
Does it really matter if they are killing people?
Mary said. He looked at her.
Where did you park your car?
Couple hundred yards from the camper, off the logging road.
Good. Maybe we can get there without it, or them, seeing us. You can take us in. We can talk about it somewhere safer than here.
I'll need your guns.
No. If that thing pops up, you probably won't see it. It's got some kind of electronic camouflage, and we need to tag it before it does us. Three shooters are better than one.
Mac considered it. We need to get moving, deputy.
Mac. Call me Mac.
If it is ahead of us or behind us, either way, we can't stay here.
Vigouti arrived, and a quick scout of the area revealed that, save for the dead ones, she was alone.
Good.
She used her wrist blades to disable the vehicles, a four-wheeled one and three two-wheelers. Slashed the tires on the wheeled house, too. Should have done that earlier. She found a perfect place where she could watch the dwelling, then decided it was too perfect. Were she in the Uman's minds, she would note that spot upon arrival. There was a second location. Not as good, but sufficient. She went there. Even in stealth, they had killed Nakande.
How?
It did not matter. Only that it had happened. She had to assume they might spot her, unless she had complete cover. Nakande had made a fatal error. She would not. She must control her rage. Her mate was gone, and a foolish gesture on her part might gain her similar results. The old Uman and his mate seemed no less deadly than the stories. Sloane said,
We're thinking that it, or they, will probably have beaten us to the RV and set up there.
Can we get to your car without being seen if they are there?
Yeah, we need to circle to the east, through the gully. Harder going that way.
Beats the other option.
Yeah.
Vigouti settled, calmed her breathing, and waited. A hunter had to be patient. Nakande had been a good hunter and fighter, but patience had not been high on his list of virtues. He was strong and fast, and that had been enough until now. She would spike them. Skewering and carving would have been more satisfying, but she was not going to underestimate them. All the Ya'utja who had done so thus far, including her mate, had died for so doing. Quick and clean, take the skull and go home, where she would have to explain to her young why their sire was not with her.
He made a mistake, she would say. Learn from this.
The gully was more or less dry, but fairly steep, descending and climbing. The RV was 100 or so meters to the west, not visible through the thick forest. With luck, they would climb out, work their way down the dirt road to the deputy's cruiser, and get the hell away before their stalkers knew they were gone. Sloan and Mary had never spoken of what happened in Alaska to anyone, but that cat was out of the bag now. Whoever in the federal government was in charge of alien cleanup would have to come and do some work here, but that was something to worry about later. First, they needed to get clear. They climbed the slope up the other side of the gully. Come the October rains, this would be a river, but that wasn't something he needed to worry about either. Almost at the top, Mac grabbed a dry sapling for support, and the wrist-thick bowl snapped off just below his hand. Made a loud crack in the quiet morning. "Shit," Mac said. He caught at a low branch on a big fir tree and stopped his slide down the slope. Sloan held a finger to his lips for silence. They listened. He was trusting Mary's and Mac's ears more than his own, but he held his breath, straining to hear. Nothing. It was a long way off. Maybe the sound hadn't carried. "Go," he said, "quickly." Vagauti heard the noise from the forest. Not close, not that far. A branch breaking, she knew the sound. She'd heard more than one large prey animal fleeing her make such sounds. They were circling the dwelling. They sought to come in from an unexpected direction, because they suspected a trap. This was the mark of prey, who was also a hunter. Smart. She considered her strategy and tactics. She could easily change her position and find a better vantage to cover that arc of the perimeter. Or she could go to meet them when they didn't expect her. Surprise might still exist there, but no longer here, not as much. They might not know exactly where she was, but they would be alert. Two of them, both armed? They would separate as they arrived, and if she lanced one, the other would have a target. That is what she would do in their place. She needed them together. She stood. Mac said, "The cruiser's just around the turn ahead." Sloan nodded. "Why don't you give me the keys? I'll go get it, bring it back. No point in all three of us getting closer than we need." The deputy frowned. "I'll do that. My car." Sloan said, "We'll cover you." Vagauti smelled the vehicle before she saw it, the odor of burned petroleum distillates they used for fuel hanging thick in the air. She frowned. There had been no vehicle there before when she had scouted the area. Someone had arrived since. There were others. That was where the sniper was going, not where the dead Umans were. He meant to flee. She saw the automobile, recognized it. It was one of their law enforcement vehicles. They had a particular appearance. More armed prey. How many? She edged closer. As Mac made his way toward the cruiser, Sloan said, "We need to separate. You stay here. I'm going across the road." "Why?" "Because if one of them is about, he'll have to shift his aim fast to get both of us. If you see a flash, shoot at the source." Mary nodded. "Be careful, Sloan." "I will. Stay low and concealed." An armed Uman approached the vehicle. She couldn't spike him. The others would mark her. She might be able to get them all, but that was not the wise choice. There were at least three, perhaps more. If their intent was to flee in the vehicle, as it seemed it was, all she had to do was wait until they were all inside, unable to shoot back or dodge. Then she could spike the automobile and be done with it. Not as sporting as she would have it, but she would have the head of the Uman who slew her mate, and who, at a far remove, could criticize her for it. One against multiple, all armed, and as deadly as they came? She crept back a bit, looking for a better angle. The vehicle would be departing along the dirt path away from her. The others must be farther along that way, waiting for the ride to come to them. You couldn't spike a target if he didn't know where it was. Again, they were behaving as a hunter would behave. She had taken dangerous prey on a dozen planets. She would take these as well. She needed a better vantage point. She looked around.
Mac unlocked the car's door and opened it, took in the surroundings. Nothing. He put the shotgun into the rack. He slid onto the seat and cranked the unit, did a U-turn and started down the road, slow and easy. Didn't want to raise dust or make more noise than he had to.
Sloane saw the deputy's car roll slowly toward his position. He looked past it, into the woods. So far, so good. But he had that feeling of being watched again. Were he the alien predator, if he were there observing? How would he assess the situation? Three armed people. Dangerous to shoot if there was only one of them. Wait until everybody is in the car, then blow the car apart.
He nodded to himself. The cruiser pulled to a stop.
"Get in," Mac called.
Line of sight, Sloane thought. Where would I set up to hit the car? He had to assume they could see the car, and anybody who went to get into it.
"Mary, crouch and get into the back seat. I'm going to pretend to get into the front seat."
"Pretend?
If I squat low and open the door, then close it, they might not see what I did. Depends on the angle they have."
"Did you see something?"
"No, but they are there."
"You sure about this?"
"Yeah."
Mac said, "What are you doing?"
"I think we have a watcher. Give me 5 seconds after I close the door to get back to concealment, then stomp it, kick some dust up, and zigzag."
There was a short pause.
"Okay."
Sloane watched Mary creep toward the car's rear door. She opened it and hopped in. Sloane took a deep breath and moved in a low crouch, duck-walked to the passenger side front door. He opened it, then shut it quickly.
"Either they see me or not. If they do, they won't take the shot. If not..."
He scooted back into the brush and dropped prone.
3, 2, 1.
Mac tromped on the gas pedal, and the tires threw up dirt and dust. The car fishtailed, got traction, and took off. Sloane scanned the road and woods, looking, looking. Vigouti targeted the vehicle. It spewed dust, obscuring her vision, but they were all inside. Now was the time.
Nothing. Sloane didn't see that shimmer he was looking for. Maybe he was wrong.
A cone fell from the big Douglas fir tree across the road. He saw it drop, followed the line back up.
"You were a challenge, sniper. I offer respect. But in the end, the Ya'utja are better hunters. Death comes for you."
"In the tree.
It's in the tree. Where?"
Had to be that thick branch 5 meters up. Nothing smaller would support the thing's weight. He couldn't see it. No blur.
Shit.
Close to the trunk, squatting on the branch, leaning against the bole. Had to be. No time. If it was going to shoot, he had to beat it. Sloane lined his sight up on what looked to be empty space and pressed the trigger. Vigouti started to command the spike and then felt a terrible, terrible pain in her left side. She fell. Sloane heard the impact, felt the ground shake, and he had already drawn his revolver. No death rays. Was it just the one? He waited, handgun pointed at where the invisible thing had hit the ground. Vigouti couldn't breathe. The impact had knocked the air from her lungs. Blood gouted from the wounds, front and back. A rib was broken. The shock had wrecked her insides. But she wasn't dead yet. She managed to climb to her feet. The stealth confounder shut off, damaged by the fall. She became visible to the shooter. She knew roughly where he had to be. She sent a spike low, because he would be prone. The ground, half a meter to Sloane's left, erupted as the energy weapon dug a 2-meter-long trench deep into the earth. Dirt and heat sprayed him. He lined his revolver sights up, center of mass, and fired. 60 meters. Not that hard a shot with his handgun. The predator went down. No other energy bolts came his way. Just the one. More would be shooting. He came up. Behind him, Mary said, "Did you get it?"
"Yes."
Mac was just behind her. Think there might be others?
No, I'd be dead. The three of them walked to where the dying or dead alien lay sprawled on the fir needles. It was smaller than the others.
A young one?
No. Wait. It was a female. She looked up at Sloane, said something in a truly foreign language, laughed, sounded like a laugh, then coughed and died.
Man, Max said, look at that. Never seen anything like it.
Sloane saw something. He was wearing a
watch?
Flashing something.
Oh, hell! Get in the car! Go! Go! Sloane said.
What?
It has some kind of self-destruct device. It's going to blow up. A big explosion. Go!
They ran. They were half a mile away when the bomb went off, and the shock wave spun the car sideways on the road as if shoved by a giant hand. After a moment, when they realized they weren't going to die, Mac laughed nervously.
I can't believe it. I can't believe any of that just happened.
Sloane looked at Mary, who smiled. Then he turned back to the deputy.
After a couple times, it gets easier to believe, he said.
May Blood Pave My Way Home by Weston Oakes. Central Mexico, 1916. A gibbous moon lit the world with a specter of what it could have been. The light had been enough to push forward until their mounts were faltering. Dun-colored ground gave way to dark lumps, creosote and mesquite scrub, indistinguishable from the men that slumbered. Lieutenant Providence Pope made his way through the field of sleeping soldiers, his bones aching from 14 hours in the saddle. Everyone had slept where they'd fallen except him and Sunderson. They couldn't bed down until they were sure their men were taken care of, and guards were set. Then, afterwards, Sunderson wanted to huddle up and spread out his maps. Those damn maps. As if a map could tell him everything.
Maps don't say nothing the land don't want you to know,
Husker John was always fond of saying. The big sergeant spoke the truth. Pope had tried to convince Sunderson of this, but the man ignored him. They'd both learned the same curriculum, albeit 4 years apart, the lessons of the Civil War drilled into them in class after class at West Point. But this wasn't two pitched armies fighting each other. This wasn't Gettysburg, nor was it the first or second battle of Bull Run. Both Pope and Sunderson could quote line and verse the timelines of each of those battles, map them in a sandbox, then rattle off the mistakes each side had made. No, this was more like Indian fighting, where one force chased the other until the other turned to fight, then turned once more and fled. Ever since Pope had been assigned B Troop and the famed Buffalo Soldiers, chasing Comanches and Apaches along the border, he'd known that they had to learn new tactics. He'd turned to Buffalo Soldiers like Sergeant Major Husker John, who'd been fighting in the all-black cavalry for 20 years, or the old man Fitz Lee, who'd won a medal for bravery during the Battle of San Juan Hill in the old Cuban campaign. They were more knowledgeable about the act of war than any of the retired colonels and majors teaching back at West Point. And now, here they were, exhausted, bedded down in a valley with high ground on all sides, selected specifically by Sunderson because it appeared to be a place where they could bed down unseen. Damn Sunderson. The East Coaster was going to get them all killed.
Lieutenant Pope, sir, came a rough voice off to his right. You be wanting some coffee?
Two soldiers sat beside a smoldering pile of ashes, the outward glow hidden by dirt and rocks. Each wore the cavalry blue uniforms with yellow piping. Dark blue for the top with copper buttons the Indians were fond of taking, and a lighter blue for the pants, each leg tucked into scuffed and worn cavalry boots. They wore utility belts that carried a canteen and ammo for their model 1896 Krag Jorgensen carbines, which lay beside each of them. They each wore slouch hats, which differed from the Stetsons worn by Pope and Sunderson. Pope strode over and squatted with them, holding out the dusty tin cup that usually hung at his waist for just such a moment.
Sure, thanks. He glanced at the two, but didn't recognize them. "I'm Private Pyle, and this here's Private Steve," the one who'd offered the coffee said. "Steve, is that your whole name?" Pope asked, eyeing the dark man. "Father's name was Steve. My mama wanted him to be remembered, so I'm Steve Steve." "Where are you from?" Pope asked. "Biloxi, sir." "This your first mission, Private?" "Yes, sir," the man said, his head and eyes lowered. Pope had seen that sort of behavior plenty. 50 years after the abolition of slavery, and still, black folk were afraid of the white man. He knew there were places where times hadn't really changed, but he'd never been there. Born and raised in the Hudson Valley of New York, then an appointment to the U.S. Military Academy at West Point where he had black classmates, had given him a different view of the state of black and white in America. Being posted to an all-black military regiment whose honors and glory were world-renowned put an exclamation point on it. "Well, Private, you're in a proud unit, so hold your head high. No bowing and scraping here." "I told him, L.T. Pope, but he wouldn't listen. I told him us Buffalo soldiers was the most decorated cavalry in the entire West. Private Steve, let me say this. General Black Jack Pershing wants his soldiers to keep their heads up so that they can see the enemy. You can't see them from staring at the ground. You get me?" "Yes, sir," said Private Steve, staring at the ground. Then he caught himself. A shadow of a grin flitted across his face. Then he looked at Pope for the first time. "I mean, yes, sir." Pope patted him on the back. "Good man." Then he stood, pulled out his pocket watch, and shook his head. "Gotta go see a man about some maps," he grumbled. Pope threw back the rest of his coffee, clipped his cup to his belt, then headed to the command tent, formulating as he went the latest argument he was going to make to try and persuade Captain Sunderson to listen to him. Then he saw movement out of the corner of his right eye. He thought it was a man, but when he turned, there was no one there. Still, he watched as a bush moved, then another, then a tripod of rifles fell. He didn't see who it was, and there wasn't even a whisper of a wind, but it looked like the passage of a man. He let out a cry, pulled his pistol from his belt, and ran to the fallen rifles. Men leaped from their positions, grabbing at their weapons, looking around. The whole camp awoke, and they searched for an hour until it was clear that no one was there. Still, he had the guard doubled, just in case. "You seeing ghosts, Pope?" sneered Captain Sunderson when it was all said and done. He was commander of A Troop, the leader of their reconnaissance party, a prima donna and a horse's ass. But Pope had seen what he'd seen. He just didn't know what it was. "Better safe than sorry," he mumbled, then squatted down to watch Sunderson play at his maps. They were 10 days into what was left of the punitive expedition, where General Black Jack Pershing took nearly 10,000 men into Mexico to retaliate against Pancho Villa for his attacks on United States sovereign soil. Things hadn't gone well from the start. Pancho Villa had turned out to be a virtual ghost. Then, after the Battle of Carrizal, a messenger had arrived, informing the general that he and the army were being recalled. Not only was the Mexican government at odds with the idea that nearly 10,000 United States soldiers were 500 miles deep in their country, chasing after Pancho Villa and his army, but President Wilson wanted the 10th Cavalry Regiment heading east for a boat to send them to the war in Europe. Pope remembered the moment well. He'd been in the general's tent and had felt the full-on power of an angry glower. Pope had done what Private Steve had done, his gaze seeking solace somewhere near the ground. The general's words were directed at President Woodrow Wilson, and no one in the tent would ever dare relay them or even say them aloud for fear of being dispatched by a line of 7 soldiers with rifles. "Scouts have Villa moving west," Sunderson began, pointing at the map. "Makes sense that they're heading to Guanajuato," pronouncing the J. Pope sighed. "There's no evidence Villa's anywhere near Guanajuato," he said, pronouncing the word correctly, replacing the J sound with an H sound. I know, your recon has it that we are, but there is... as... go ahead and say what you mean, Lieutenant," Sunderson said in his patronizing Virginia drawl. We both know I haven't seen combat until this expedition. I didn't mean it like that, sir, Pope said in frustration. It's just that I know what it's like to chase Comanches. They have a certain way of moving through a country. I can't pinpoint exactly how I know, but by God, sir, we're chasing Indians, not Villa. And the recon boys from the motorcycle squad, they don't matter. The punitive expedition had been the first time the U.S. military had used motorcycles in battle. They'd been mainly used for reconnaissance and message delivery. Pershing had given their 100-man element 2 motorcycles. I'm surprised they can see anything as loud as those machines can get. Comanches can hear them coming a mile away, and let's face it, they have zero experience chasing Comanches. Just like me. You said it, sir. Fine, Pope. I've heard your arguments for the last 10 days. Let me ask you this. What would you do if you were in command? I'd split our forces into 2. Your men know more about chasing Indians than 50 West Point grads. I learned that lesson the hard way when I arrived to take command. He pointed to the place on the map. Problem as I see it is that we're currently huddled in this valley. If I was Comanche, I'd be holed up here and... The tent flap opened and Husker John shoved his head inside. His wiry hair was cut into a mohawk, an ugly mass of scars twisted the right side of his head where he'd almost been scalped. Sunderson frowned. What are you doing interrupting us, boy? Husker John ignored the remark, his eyes on Pope. We got a problem, sir. Sentries to the west and south are gone. What do you mean, gone? Sunderson asked. Just that, sir. Gone. Are the men prepared? Pope asked. Yes, sir. Word is spreading. They'll be ready. Sunderson grabbed Pope's shoulder. What are you talking about? I didn't hear any alarm. This is Indian country, sir. We don't sound alarms in cases like these. What I did earlier was different. I thought someone was in our camp. In fact, there might have been someone. Your men know what to do. The Comanches think they have us at a surprise, but we know better. Pope made to stand, then paused. You need to trust your men, sir. Then he left, heading straight for the center of his troop. He kept his eyes down, but noted the many shadows that dotted the sides of the hills surrounding them. He kneeled by Husker John. Have the men prepare to fire. Husker John gave the low call of an owl. As it echoed across the valley, the buffalo soldiers of B and A troops slowly rolled onto their bellies and aimed into the darkness. They'd practiced this maneuver before and had used it effectively against a Comanche attack just south of Agua Prieta last year. Fire! Pope whispered. Husker John screeched like the owl of its name and 100 rifles fired, grazing fire only a foot off the ground. Screams split the night as Comanche warriors who'd been crawling toward their location were suddenly struck by bullets fired along the ground. Fire! Pope shouted and pulled out his pistol. Fire at will! Those Comanches who'd stood to flee were shot down. The cacophony of firing was intense as rifles from both sides fired, filling the air with dark, blinding smoke, making it even harder to see in the wan moonlight. Then Pope saw movement toward B Troop's flag. The strangest-looking Comanche he'd ever seen seemed to pop into existence. The Comanche wore strange armor and had even stranger hair. As the Comanche began reaching for the flag, Pope leveled his pistol, took aim down the 8-inch barrel and shot the warrior in the back. The warrior spun, his hair whipping around behind him. He held a strange pistol in his hand. Pope fired again, catching the warrior in the chest, knocking him back a step. The warrior fired, the bullet expanding improbably into a net. Pope dove to his right, the net brushing his shoulder but passing over him. It caught Private Steve on the head, and Pope watched in horror as the net contracted, the mesh biting into skin until blood shot free. But he didn't have time to watch it all. He turned and fired, unloading the last 4 bullets of his pistol into the strange warrior. At first, he didn't think that his bullets had any effect, but then the warrior staggered, and as he did, he flashed in and out of existence. Pope surged to his feet, but before he could even take a step, Husker John plowed past him and tackled the strange warrior. Husker John grabbed a stone from the ground and with 2 hands brought it down on the warrior's head once, then twice. Pope turned to get his bearings. His men were kneeling and prone, firing at moving shadows. He saw several of his men go down and cursed every time. He loaded his pistol with steady hands,
remembering fleetingly his first Indian fight and how terrified he'd been. The memory made him look toward A Troop, where Sunderson's men were gathered en masse around him, as if they were a Roman legion forming a cohort block. Their rate of fire was impressive, but they made even better targets. Then Pope understood. He'd had his men surround him as human shields. Fucking Sunderson. Three of Sunderson's men went down, then three more right after. Pope watched as one of the men seemed to be pulled into the air and thrown, the body crashing to the ground in an awkward twisting of limbs. One of the motorcycles exploded, lighting the night. Someone opened with their sole model 1895 10-barrel Gatling gun. Horses screamed. Pope scrambled over to Husker John and saw the Comanche for the first time up close. Husker John glanced up with big eyes.
"What kind of Comanche is this, sir?" "None I've ever seen." The Comanche wore armor of a sort. It felt like metal, but it was softer. It also seemed to have a mask of some kind over its face. This was no Comanche. This was a completely different Indian altogether. Pope snatched the warrior's pistol from where it had fallen on the ground. He expected it to be heavy, but it was amazingly light. Suddenly, a Comanche broke through the lines and ran toward them. Pope raised the pistol and fired. A net grew out of thin air and caught the Comanche on the head, knocking him back and slamming him to the ground. The strange warrior stirred. "M'di makt," it said, the alien words coming from beneath the mask. Then it repeated, "M'di makt." "Doesn't sound Comanche," Husker John said. "It's because this isn't a Comanche." Pope stood, now a gun in each hand. "I don't know what he is." Another of the strange warriors blinked into existence. This one was taller and held a long spear with a wicked-looking end. The warrior moved incredibly fast, dodging bullets, slashing down the men of B Troop with the ease of a farmer slashing wheat. It became apparent to Pope that the warrior was heading his way. He felt a moment of fear take him as he watched the effortlessness with which the warrior was cutting down his men. Pope backed a few steps and knelt beside the downed warrior. He holstered his pistol, then pressed the side of the strange warrior's gun to its head. "Husker John, get behind me," Pope said. He watched as the new warrior cut down three more of his men, then skidded to a stop, the long rectangular blade of the spear stopping inches from Pope's face. "Drop your weapon, or I'll kill him." Pope didn't know if the other understood him. He just had to hope it did. "Drop your weapon, or I'll kill him," the warrior said in return.
Pope blinked in confusion as he heard his own words said back to him.
"Who are you?" Pope asked.
"Who are you?" the warrior asked back in his voice. The warrior was taller than the one they had on the ground. He wore the skeletal remains of what looked like a bear claw on a dark chain around his neck. His dark armor reminded Pope of pictures he'd seen of knights during the Crusades, but this one was articulated to allow for easy movement. His head was covered by the same mask as the one Pope had at the end of the pistol. Pope noted that most of the firing had stopped.
"Is it the devil, L.T. Pope?"
Husker John whispered. Pope shook his head as he looked at his left hand that was holding the warrior in a sitting position.
"The devil don't bleed."
His hand was coated in a luminous green substance, and he thought to himself, if the devil could bleed, wouldn't it be green? "I'm not playing around," he said to the standing warrior. "Who are you and why are you here?" The warrior's head turned slightly as if he were regarding a new thing. Then he said in an accent Pope didn't recognize,
"We are Yautja,"
pronouncing the word like Yautja.
"We fight with Comanches."
The cadence of the words was unnatural.
"Comanches are our enemy," Pope said flatly. "Does that make you our enemy as well?"
The Yautja turned its head again as if it were listening to something.
"Uman kvar uman," it said.
Then in English, it translated,
"Humans hunting humans."
Then came the sound of clicking from inside the mask. Pope considered the statement and said, "We hunt them because they hunt us. We hunt first so that they will not hunt last. The Yautja lowered its spear, then spun it several times until the blade was pointed down. Shouts came from behind the Yautja. Pope lowered the pistol. Several of his men were gathering behind the Yautja, weapons raised. A crazy idea came to Pope, one that had to be acted on at once. He stood, pulling the wounded Yautja to its feet. "Here, take him. I don't know how to heal him." The Yautja hesitated a moment, then stepped forward and took the weight of the smaller Yautja, whose back glowed with smears of green luminescent blood. Now that Pope was standing, he noted that the Yautja was head and shoulders again taller than he was.
"Lieutenant Pope, what do you have there?" came Sunderson's voice.
"Go." "Now," Pope said, jerking his head to his left. Then loudly he said, "Do not harm these two. Let them go free on my command." The Yautja held the smaller warrior in its arms and began to walk away.
"Lieutenant Pope, what are you doing?"
"Letting them take their wounded."
"What? I've never heard of such a thing. Belay that order and fire at will." "Do not fire!" Pope shouted.
The men looked nervously from Sunderson to Pope, but listened to the white officer who'd been with them the longest.
"I've had about enough of this," Sunderson said in exasperation. He drew his pistol and fired it into the back of the retreating Yautja.
The giant warrior halted. He turned his head slightly, and a piece of metal the size of a small plate flew from him to embed in Sunderson's chest. Sunderson gasped and let his pistol fall from his hand. He dropped clumsily to his knees and coughed blood. Pope ran to him. A metal disc was sticking half out of Sunderson's chest. Pope touched it and could feel it vibrate beneath his fingers. He watched in awe as the disc worked its way backwards, then flew back to the Yautja, who somehow caught it, then disappeared with the wounded warrior as if they'd never been there at all. Buffalo soldiers all around began to whisper and curse. Several got down on their knees to pray. Still more stood, unable to move, staring at the spot where the Yautja had just been. Sunderson drew one last ragged breath and then collapsed. Dead. The rest of the night found Pope directing his men in parties of five to collect the dead and clear the battlefield. A triage area had been set aside to help the wounded. They set new sentries, this time doubling them. Pope believed they'd do well against the Comanches, but probably wouldn't have a chance with the Yautja, especially the big one with the spear. It wasn't until shortly before dawn that he had enough time to sit down and think. Private Pyle brought him some much-needed coffee. He mentioned that Private Steve hadn't made it, but then Pope already knew that. Too many good soldiers had died that day. He reviewed their losses on the tally sheet Husker John had provided. Of the 100 men who'd entered the valley, 65 remained alive, and of that number, 39 were unscathed. Pope surmised that half of their number of dead had been killed by the Yautja. Husker John sat heavily beside him.
"We going back now, sir?"
Pope nodded. "That's the plan. Enough of us died last night."
"What was it for? Who was they?"
"Yautja is what it called itself. I don't know what they are."
"The men are calling it a demon. Do you think it could be a demon, sir?"
Pope sipped his coffee, which was the only thing keeping him awake. Exhaustion made him feel weighted down.
"I don't know what a demon is, Husker John. Is it a demon? It could be, but I'm not so sure. It had a way about it."
"It bled green, sir," Husker John said in a hushed tone.
"The important thing was that it bled," Pope said, and then exhaustion clamped down on everything and sent him into darkness.
When next he woke, Corporal Motes was shaking him awake. Pope blinked at the brightness of the day. The sun was high enough in the sky for it to be late morning. He dreamed of a girl he'd once courted from a wealthy Hudson Valley family. She had luxurious blonde hair and left the smell of lilacs and orange in her wake. Then he sat up straight and looked around, shedding the last vestiges of his walk with a pretty girl.
"Sir, Sergeant Major wanted me to wake you."
Pope wiped his face as if he could wipe away the tiredness and got to his feet. He tucked in his shirt that had come loose and adjusted his pants. Corporal Motes had been with the unit for 10 years and was a seasoned soldier. A ragged scar cut his left cheek, puckering his high yellow skin. Because of the scar, it always looked like Motes was smiling, but Pope knew otherwise. Motes' entire family had been killed by the Klan back in Kentucky, and he'd come out west to forge a new life. Husker John had told Pope that not a night went by where Motes wasn't staring into the sky. What he was thinking about, no mystery to any man that knew him. "What's going on?" Pope asked. He leaned down and picked up his tin cup. Cold, stale coffee stirred in the bottom. He considered it, then brought it to his lips and drank it. Cold as it was still something that could speed him to wake. Motes pointed toward the east end of camp. "We have a visitor, sir." "Who is it, Corporal?" "An old mule skin is sent by the Comanches. Says he has something to tell you, but he'll only tell you." "Sentry still out?" "All out and watching. Was the motorcycle that saw the mule skinner and brought him." Pope smiled. The Comanches probably knew the motorcycle routes and told the mule skinner where to go. "Thank you, Corporal." He turned to go, then turned back. "You and the men eat yet?" "We had us some tack and water, sir." "Think you could scrounge me up some?" Pope asked. The last thing he wanted to eat was hard tack. Small square crackers tasted like dust, but an army on the move didn't always have the luxury of real rations, so he'd eat it and pretend half-heartedly that it was something better. Maybe a cookie made by that girl he'd met at West Point. Damned if he could remember her name, just her smell and the feel of her hair in his fingers. He knew he should know. She'd been special to him. But when he'd come out fighting, he'd shoved all the memories of everything good into a deep, dark hole to protect them. Why this one was surfacing now, he didn't know. "Oh, yes, sir," Corporal Motes said, nodding. Then he took off jogging. Lieutenant Pope made his way to where Sergeant Major Husker John was detaining the mule skinner, who was on his knees. The man was a half-breed and going on 60. His gray hair was bundled up behind him Indian style, but a few wisps blew free in the breeze. His face was pocked from disease. His eyes had a reedy film over them. "What's this?" Pope asked. Husker John shifted his considerable weight to his right foot and shoved the mule skinner with his left foot, knocking him onto his back. "The man says he has a message for you, sir." "Did he do anything to offend you, Sergeant Major?" Pope asked. "Yes, sir. He's half Indian, sir," Husker John said in his baritone. "That's as good a reason to hate a man as any, I suppose, especially in these parts. Out with it, then. What message do you have for me?" The mule skinner glanced fearfully at Husker John, then said, "Comanche sent me. Said they have a thing they want you to know. Something you have to do." "Out with it, then," Pope urged, wondering where Motes had got to. "The Nanasuwukaitu. They demand you fight. They say your fight with them is undone." "And who are these nanny wacko?" "They call them Yautja, but they're spirits. None can stand before them, and they can walk the spirit plane. It's where they go when they disappear." Pope raised an eyebrow. "Is that so? What do they want with us?" "They say that four of them will fight four of your best warriors."
"Then what?"
"All of your men can go free."
"But they're free now."
"No,"
the mule skinner said, glancing around, fear owning the features of his face.
"You're not. The Nanasuwukaitu are all around us. They're just in spirit form."
The idea that they were surrounded by an invisible army of Yautja left Pope cold. He turned, slowly, examining the shadows. Three times a Yautja made itself briefly appear, then disappear like it was making itself known. Each time it happened, a bolt of fear shot through Pope's gut. "My men go free if we win or lose?" Pope asked. The mule skinner glanced wildly behind him.
"That's what they said."
"And how do I know they'll keep their word?"
"They have a strange honor, sir. That's how they came to us. They fought our best. We lost, but that didn't stop them from joining us, helping us. They've been with us almost 6 months now."
"So four of my people fight four of their Yautja."
"That's right. The Nanasuwukaitu love to fight. They don't drink. They don't play games. They fight."
Pope turned to his sergeant major. "What do you think?"
"I think we should skin this mule skinner and send him back to his mother, sir."
He took off his slouch hat and rubbed his hand through his wiry hair, then put the hat back on, making sure the bill was centered.
But if we have a way of saving the men, then we need to be doing that.
There is that. Pope shook his head. He didn't like the idea of it, but he feared he had no other choice.
Go and tell them we'll oblige.
Where and when?
You can tell them yourself.
The mule skinner pointed further east.
He's waiting for you in the next valley. Just send four, and they will too.
Pope turned to Husker John.
Let the man go. We have to plan.
Pope knew that he couldn't send any man to do what he wouldn't do. That's not what leadership was, so he was the first of the four. His mother had named him Providence so he'd have a lucky life. It had worked out so far, and it might carry him through the day. Husker John also insisted on coming. Pope was relieved to hear it because there was no other he thought could stand a chance. As fate would have it, Motes arrived as they were discussing who next to ask, and he volunteered himself. Motes was a fine enough soldier, and they were unlikely to get anyone better, so they accepted him to their doomed group. Pope left the pair to get ready and went to find Conroy, who was a classic Irishman who'd fight at the color of the sky being blue. He was one of the only other white men in the troop now that Sunderson was dead, assigned to them as part of the motorcycle unit. In the end, he took very little convincing, and Pope soon had his four dead men. Pope, Motes, and Husker John each carried a rifle and a pistol. They also each had a skinning knife and hatchet they'd plucked from the bodies of dead Apaches. Conroy carried a breech-loading sawed-off shotgun, a pistol, a spear, and a knife. He also brought his motorcycle and drove it along beside their horses, which had become accustomed to the rackety machines during the long expedition.
"Let's run down what we know about them," Pope said as they walked. Then he laughed as he realized,
"We really don't know anything, do we?"
"They come in different sizes, sir," Motes said. "That they do. They also have different weapons. That may be based on size, but it could also be based on rank."
"So you think these Yautjas have a rank system?"
Conroy asked.
"They're warriors. Maybe even soldiers. They have to have a ranking system. It's why I let the big fella take the wounded Yautja. Never leave a man behind, right?"
"Makes sense, I suppose," Conroy said. "So how's the fight going down? Who do I get to hit first?"
Pope raised an eyebrow. "I'm not exactly sure, but I'll tell you what. As soon as I know, you'll know."
Conroy snorted, "Spoken like a privileged West Pointy."
Turned out that the next valley was 5 miles away. It also wasn't much of a valley, a box canyon, really, ending in a cul-de-sac of rocks the size of rail cars. The flat space was probably 60 by 60 feet and covered in dirt and dry grass. He'd seen this on a map, but the map didn't show the impressive sizes of the rocks or how they rose like giant stacked blocks into a three-sided wall. They tied the horses to a scrap of mesquite where Pope thought they'd be well out of the way. Conroy parked the motorcycle beside the horses. Then all four moved to the center of the space and waited. For exactly 10 seconds, and then four Yautja appeared 20 feet from them. More Yautja appeared on the rocks. Pope hoped they were merely spectators and that they hadn't walked into one immense trap. By appearances, the Yautja matched the buffalo soldiers in size. One large hulking warrior stood out among three warriors closer to human size. It was as if the Yautja selected the size specifically to match that of the humans. Interesting, thought Pope. If his observation was true, it spoke to a fairness of fight that left him hopeful that the Yautja would keep their bargain. A fifth Yautja appeared. This one he recognized as the giant warrior from the previous night's combat. He stepped between both groups, then turned to the buffalo soldiers.
"Four fight, then done,"
it said, its accent and cadence still peculiar to Pope's ears.
"Weapons?"
Pope asked.
"Two only."
"They have armor, sir,"
Husker John noted.
"Good catch."
Then to the Yautja, Pope said, "If this is to be a fair fight, your warriors should remove their armor."
The Yautja cocked its head.
The other four, who had been standing impressively, suddenly were looking at each other. Was it worry? Pope hoped so.
"If no armor, then none of your loud weapons."
Pope thought for a moment, trying to parse what a loud weapon was, then he got it, the pistols and rifles. Perhaps the Yautja armor provided a modicum of protection from their bullets, Without it, they'd surely fall victim. It was a fair offer. Speaking to the Yautja, Pope said, "That's a deal. But one more thing." He made a circle with his hands and then made to throw it. "No using that disc you shot into Sunderson." The Yautja cocked its head once more, then made a series of clicking sounds from beneath the mask. "These Yautja do not use this weapon. They are not ready for it." Pope nodded. "To the death, then?" he asked, hoping it wasn't. "To the death." "Excellent," Pope said, meaning anything but. He backed his men away, and they began to remove their hats and shirts. They deposited their weapons in a pile. Corporal Motes was the first to notice the other Yautja, who were removing their weapons and their masks. When he saw their faces, his eyes shot wide and his mouth hung open. "Jesus, Mary and Joseph, what are they?" The Buffalo soldiers turned and fell in a state of awe as they saw what lay beneath the masks. Pope identified the wondrous protrusions from the face as some sort of mandibles, like from a gigantic insect. Each one ended in a tooth or a claw or a talon. Whichever, they looked sharp and deadly. Suddenly all four Yautja began clicking their mandibles together. Their shoulders shook slightly. Then Pope realized they were laughing at the Buffalo soldiers' reactions. Pope turned to his men. "So now we know they wear masks to hide their ugly mugs. Right now they're laughing at your reactions, your fear. Each of you have faced down Comanches and Apaches. Each of you have been up close and personal with someone who wanted you dead. This is no different. The Yautja are just a different type of Indian to us. That's all, pure and simple. Most of all, remember that they can bleed just like you or me. If they can bleed, they can die. You understand?" Both Conroy and Husker John nodded, but Motes looked doubtful. Pope grabbed him and shook him. "Motes! Did you hear me?" Motes nodded slowly, then his nodding picked up speed. "I hear you, sir." Pope thought for a moment against saying what he was about to say, but then dove in. "Listen, you were never able to get back at the clan for what they did to your family." Motes turned to stare at him as hatred bled the fear away from his eyes. "Look at the Yautja." Motes turned to stare at them. "These are the clan. These would kill your family all over again. You couldn't hurt the clan, but you can hurt these warriors. Do you understand? Do you understand me, Corporal Motes?" Motes shrugged off Pope's hands and said, "Yes, I understand, sir." His voice mean and ready. "Then let's go." Pope and his men turned and took a few steps forward. "We're ready," he said. The giant Yautja beckoned one of the human-sized warriors forward. This one's skin was mottled with greens and browns. Its face was fierce in the way a demon's would be. For the Buffalo soldiers, these might as well be demons, but they still bled, and they could still die, so they had a chance. Pope started forward to meet it, but Motes pushed him back and strode to the center. Like the rest of them, Motes wore his pants tucked into his boots, a white undershirt and suspenders. He held a hatchet in his right hand and a skinning knife in his left. Pope couldn't see his face, but the soldier's head was held high. His opponent raised its shoulders and flared its mandibles. It wore twin metal claws on each hand. Pope waited for a signal to start, but there was none. The Yautja just charged. Motes stepped his left foot back and waited. His opponent swung both of its arms, but Motes dove under them, bringing his hatchet around and cutting a slice from the Yautja's thigh. His opponent tumbled. Motes controlled his roll, then rose elegantly to his feet. Pope felt a surge of elation as his hope for their survival went from nothing to something. The Yautja got to its feet and spun. Instead of charging this time, it stalked Motes. But the Buffalo soldier stood his ground. When the Yautja swung at him this time, he backed away, let his opponent miss, then lunged with his knife. The Yautja kicked out with one of its legs, knocking the knife away. Motes paused to stare at the weapon as it flew through the air, and it was his downfall. The Yautja brought its other hand around and swiped away Motes' windpipe. Blood spurted wildly as Motes fell to his knees. The warrior brought a metal-clawed hand down on top of the skull, embedding the claws in the bone. Then it raked its other hand once more against the neck, separating the head from the body. The victorious Yautja turned to its fellow warriors and let out an unearthly shriek as it held its bloody trophy high. Pope's elation almost died with Motes, but he knew that they had a chance. It was just that Motes had made a deadly mistake. Husker John strode forward, grabbed Motes' body and brought it back. Blood dripped down the back of his undershirt, but he didn't take any notice.